We'll call to order the House Revenue Committee meeting this morning and welcome everybody here. We have two bills up for consideration today and then a couple of bill introductions at the end. First is House Bill 2424. And let me open the public hearing on House Bill 2424 and invite up Dexter. There you are. You were in the back. Dexter Johnson from Legislative Council. Paul, do you have anything on the staff to give us before we go to Dexter?
Mr. Chairman, this for members' first time on revenue. This is a biennial event. The Legislative Council goes through our tax statutes and reviews them and recommends syntax and making language more consistent across all the tax statutes.
Okay. Dexter, good morning.
Mr. Chair and members, good morning. Dexter Johnson, Legislative Council Office. As Paul summarized, that is the Tax Revisors Bill, which you have before you, is the bill that we use to make very technical corrections to the Oregon tax statutes. Most of these corrections come to light after the regular session when we prepare the next edition of ORS. And none of these changes are substantive changes. They are just basically to make the provisions of ORS consistent with one another, to correct internal references, to correct grammar, that sort of thing. Other than that, that's pretty much all I have to say about the bill, but if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Williams.
I do notice, Dexter, that there are a number of definition sections this time where terms like specific request or exempt bonded indebtedness or maintenance and repairs, the need for which could be reasonably anticipated, or sections where there's defining going on. Is this just essentially rewriting previously existing definitions to sort of tighten them up, or is this completely new language for the definitions?
Mr. Chair, Representative Williams, actually it is neither. It is most of the time, I believe, in these, they are simply alphabetizing the definitions, which is the makes them consistent with legislative form and style. And it's been something we have been changing over a period of years.
So, for example, where in on page 21 it defines specific request means, what you're telling me is if I look closer at the bill, I would find that specific request is deleted later
on
in the section.
Page 19, line 6.
Yes.
And then re-added.
Yes.
So we're actually not changing any definitions then?
That is correct.
Okay.
No definition
Good.
Changes. Again, there's no substantive changes in this bill.
I'm glad you asked it, though. I mean, that is a lot of black bold print on a bill that's a revisor's bill, but it is true if you look through there, for instance, in section 24 on page 16, line 38, tax on property is your first definition. Obviously, that's out of order alphabetically, and so you've deleted that, and it reappears on page 22 in black bold print. So that seems to be exactly what's going on.
Yes.
So let the record reflect the witness is telling us the truth.
I never doubted it, Mr. Chair. I thought, though, that to the extent that you see new definitions
in
the bill,
yeah,
I think it's important to also make the record real clear that we're not substantively, because this will show as a this will show down at the bottom of the ORS as having been, this section having been revised in 2003. And it would help, I think, just for the legislative record for people to understand that we didn't come in and redefine what specific request meant. We simply moved it around within the statute. And so it means whatever it meant when the bill that originally defined it, and we're not redefining it today.
Well, that is correct.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Hess.
Thanks. Dexter, we changed, there was a law that changed from shall to may in a 2001 session to make that a permanent change. It is, I remember it because there were some smart aleck media stories written about that. And when legislation is coming through now, I see some of those reflected. I was just wondering, while you're here, could you tell me what that really means in terms of old laws that had May in there. Is every one of those being changed?
Yeah.
That comes through, and is that how it's even?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hass, actually in 2001 the debate was over the negative, shall not versus may not,
right.
Both of which are mandatory expressions of mandatory prohibition. However, the provision that was passed in 2001 basically said that wherever that the phrase shall not or may not means the same thing, it is a mandatory prohibition. But yeah, there was some controversy that went along with that. And the position of our office is been to not search through ORS to find every shall not and change it to a may not, but however, when a provision of ORS is being amended anyway, to change the shall not to may not, because we believe may not is actually a more proper expression of mandatory prohibition than shall not.
Okay, thanks.
Other questions? Next, I'll just express my disappointment in this one. I think I mentioned this in Judiciary Committee that unlike the other revisers bill that we get through that has all of the ORS in it, I couldn't find any nuggets in this one to make us smile and entertain us as we were trying to get through this.
Good enough.
Mr. Chair, I will keep that in mind going into session.
Yeah, Dexter, something in the little brackets that says something like, futzes with urban renewal.
Messes with syntax.
If you say futzes with urban renewal, you're going to get a room full of
that's true. All right, well done. Any other comments, questions? Anybody else wish to testify in House Bill 2424? Thank you, Dexter. With that, then I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2424 and open the work session.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Williams.
I would move House Bill 2424 to the floor of the DuPass recommendation.
Thank you very much. Representative Williams moves House Bill 2424 to the floor with a DuPass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Please call the roll.
Representative Berger.
Aye.
Barr.
Aye.
Hass.
Aye.
Hopkins.
Aye.
Scott.
Aye.
Berger.
Aye.
Williams.
Aye.
Aye. House Bill 2424 goes to the floor with the due pass. Carrier, anybody interested in this one? Representative Farr.
I would love to.
All right. You got it. Okay. Are we ready to go on 2197?
We are.
Okay. I had a note here that Representative Speaker wished to testify. Do you know how to get a hold of him, Kathy? Okay. Let's do that then. Let's open a public hearing on House Bill 2197. Dick, let's start with your overview, and then when Representative Krieger comes in, we'll take a break for his testimony. Do you have some other choreography in mind here?
I expected to do the overview kind of when you when you do the work.
That's
session.
Right. Okay, well, let's. Wally, are you ready? Okay, come on in then. Krista or whoever else you have. That's right. Forgot. Good morning, Christina.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Christina McNitt, and I'm representing the Oregon Small Woodlands Association, which is a membership association of non-industrial family forest landowners. And with me to my left is Mr. Clint Benz, who's an accountant who specializes in woodland property taxes. He operates out of Staten, and he and his family just recently were awarded the National Tree Farmer of the Year.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Christine, if I can, I'm going to mention Representative Krieger will be coming in. He's chairing a committee while we're meeting. He wanted to testify in support of this. So when he comes in, I'll interrupt you very briefly.
Bring him on. That's okay. Great. Thank you. It's truly a pleasure to be here this morning to testify in favor of House Bill 2197, which is the outcome of almost 5 years of work, including two legislatively directed task forces. House Bill 2197 is a priority piece of legislation for the Small Woodlands Association. What this legislation does is it establishes an alternative property tax system for non-industrial forest land owners who own between 10 and 5,000 acres of forest land. As a brief background, prior to 1999, industrial and non-industrial landowners both paid their respective property taxes in a split manner. 20% of the property taxes were paid on an annual basis, with the remaining 80% paid at the time of harvest. In 1999, the industry was successful in changing the tax system from the 20-80 plan to from the deferral method to a 100% ad valorem system, where landowners pay the entire amount of property taxes each year. At that time, however, recognition was given to the fact that such a system did not necessarily fit the management profiles of the family forest landowners, who typically do not harvest on an annual basis and therefore do not typically have a cash flow generation from their forest land investment. An interim committee was established in 1999 to assist the non-industrial community in coming up with an alternative. And despite the dedicated efforts of many people, that task force was unable ultimately to develop a consensus package in time for the 2001 session. Some of you may remember me petitioning you, frankly begging you, for two more years of time to continue to pursue a resolution for this session, and that is what House Bill 2197 comes to you as today. Thanks to the indulgence of the legislature, two additional years, and a second task force. The task force was charged with three things. One, that it would be acceptable to all parties. Two, that it would reduce the Department of Revenue's administrative costs for the previous deferral system. And three, would provide an incentive to encourage the small tract forest landowner to continue to maintain their investment in a forest land base. Through the expertise provided by the Departments of Revenue and Forestry, and with the leadership assistance of two outstanding professional facilitators, this second task force built upon a knowledge base provided by the first task force and examined many issues and alternatives. I think Mr. Bentz will go into more particular testimony with respect to the policy issues behind House Bill 2197 and how those fit the management profile of the non-industrial forest land owner, and then we'll probably go into a line-by-line bill summary with the departments and some examples. I appreciate the time the committee has given to this issue, both now and through the last interim, and hope you'll join us in supporting House Bill 2197 and the -1 amendments we're supporting, and we've just reviewed the -2 amendments submitted by this committee, and we're also supportive of those.
Okay. Thank you very much. Mr. Bentz, before we go to you, I see Representative Krieger. You want to come on up? You wanted to, you're in committee, and you want to testify on this bill. Representative Krieger.
Chair Shetterly, for the record, I am Representative Wayne Krieger from the South Coast. And I assume you're on House Bill 2197?
Yeah.
You just pulled me out of committee. I'm here today to support House Bill 2197. I served on the Board of Forestry from December 94 to January 2001. During the 99 and 2001, I was associated with a working group designated under House Bill 3575 and House Bill 2162. The tax model that was developed for industrial landowners, in fact, does not meet the diverse management objective of small woodland owners. The small forest landowners do not harvest every year. They, therefore, do not have cash flow to pay the 100% of the property tax as severance tax they pay at harvest as envisioned under House Bill 2197 that would better serve their needs. Remember that when small woodland owners harvest, they pay a federal income tax, a state income tax, two state forest taxes, and a property tax each year. And in many cases, some of those families are burdened with a death tax or inheritance tax. While this is going on, they're asked to provide for fish and wildlife habitat, protect water and air, and comply with ESA, the Endangered Species Act. They are, in fact, willing to be good stewards of the forest land. They also realize that stewardship in forestry requires a long-term commitment, 35 to 70 years, and sometimes more when you're on the east side. Many of us know we'll never be the recipients of the financial investments we have made. We also know that someone else will realize the benefit of our physical labors of 35 to 50 years. And for most of us, this hope is going to be in the form of a son or a daughter who will be able to leave our property to a possibly a grandchild. House Bill 2197 will help small woodland owners manage their forest lands in a sustainable manner, therefore benefiting small woodland owners themselves and also all of Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Krieger, any questions for Representative Krieger? I didn't know you were on the Board of Forest for a year up until 2001.
Yeah, until the third, and then I had to...
Yeah, right. I understand you took a change in jobs.
Thank you.
You bet. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Mr. Bentz, to you, sir.
Thank you, Representative Chair Kettley. My name is Clint Bentz, and I serve as the technical advisor to this task force that created this this bill that's before you now. I think Christina did a good job kind of explaining why we have this bill. We worked a long time to create a bill that mimicked what small woodland owners currently have and yet reduced the administrative costs significantly to the department to administer and also make it simpler for the small woodland owners to comply with the law. We found that the old way of doing this, where it was the tax was based on evaluation, created difficulties for the small woodland owners. And so by doing a tax, moving to a tax based on volume of timber harvested rather than the value of the timber harvested, that significantly reduced both the administrative burden for the department and also the ease of filling out the forms for the small woodland owner. As I've been around the state and others in the Oregon Small Woods Association, we've had enthusiastic reception of this bill. So I'm willing to answer any questions any of you have about how the bill works or what we're trying to accomplish.
Any questions? I think we are going to get the technical overview will be from the Mr. Miller and Mr. Rutledge, so we can go for that. And Dick has a... you've got some algorithms for us to look at, too. I will say, just as committee chair, for those of you especially who are new to the committee, it is true what Christina said and Mr. Bent said as well as far as the background on this. This does represent the culmination of 4 years. This goes back to the 1999 session when we changed this. And a lot of hard work. We've had this group in front of us several times during session and interims as well. And so I'm pleased to see a final product here that we're able to move on, I think. Just in the nick of time, I think committee members need to understand, too, that if we don't do this session, then basically small woodland owners will revert to the industrial tax model with full property tax imposed and paid on an annual basis. So it's sort of a last chance opportunity to get this in before we revert to that.
That's correct.
Okay. Thank you very much. Norm Miller and Wally Rutledge. Good morning.
Morning, Chair. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Norm Miller. I'm the Timber Tax Operations Supervisor for the Oregon Department of Revenue. And what I'd like to do is say a few words about the bill, go into some of the technical detail of what the bill does, who it impacts, be able to answer any of the technical questions that you have at this time. I know that there's a plan when this committee goes into the work session to go into even more detail, or to be able to go into more detail if you have further questions. So we may defer some of those questions at that time. House Bill 2197 represents a culmination of 5 years of work toward the creation of the method for matching the payment of property taxes with the flow of cash available to owners of smaller tracts of forest land. This methodology in many ways mirrors the current system for taxing small owners. The changes, for the most part, were designed to decrease the administrative costs of the program to keep the program current with forest land valuation changes that have taken place, and to bring the tax to be collected at harvest more in line with Measure 50, which is really where we started with this whole situation. I'm going to go down through, and what I'm going to do is your copy should be paperclip, so we'll have a front page that I'll separate from the rest, and I'll be flipping back and forth as we go through this. So what House Bill 2197 does is number one, creates a property tax option for small woodland owners that would tax them at 20% of their of the forest land value. The remaining 80% then would be made up as those forest land owners harvested their timber over time, and it's actually a kind of an average over time of the collection of that 80%. Let's take a look first at page 3, and let's look a little bit at who we're even dealing with here, the numbers of forest landowners, what acres they represent. But get some information on those owners, dealing with Western Oregon first. Of those owners who have 1 to 9 acres that are classified as forest land at this time, there's about 1,600 of those, or actually almost 1,700 of those forest land owners, owning about 87,000 acres of forest land. This particular bill that you're dealing with, the option, actually limits the people who can go into the option from those who own 10 acres to 5,000 acres. So the group that represents then, as you look down into the subtotal, that own between 10 and 5,000 acres of land, there are 22,161 owners owning about 1.4 million acres of forest land at this point in time. And then I included the owners that own more than 5,000 acres of land. There are 61 of those owners, representing about 4.3 million of acres of forest land in Western Oregon. Similar numbers for Eastern Oregon, so you get a feel for who we're talking about there.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
Just a quick question. What's the line of demarcation between Eastern and Western Oregon?
Chair Shetterly, representing FAR, that line of demarcation would be the west edge of Wasco counties, Deschutes, Jefferson, Klamath County. So basically it's the Cascade Range, top of the Cascade Range.
Thank you.
The summit.
So owners opting into this program may move. Well, let's go back a little. In 2003, with the current statute, all forest landowners will be taxed at 100% of the forest land value. That's what the current statute says. The change that's being suggested by this legislation then is that we extend that time period out for 1 year. So of the small woodland owners, the large woodland owners would still go on at 100% in 2003, July 1 of 2003. The small woodland owners then would extend out one more year, would actually be put on at 100% of the forest land value July 1 of 2004, unless they opt into the program that's created by this bill. Okay? Then after they opt into this program, they can choose, as they feel the need, based on their own circumstances, to move in and out of this particular program, the option to move in and out of the option. There is a penalty for doing that, and that is they would have to pay the difference between the tax at 100% and the tax at 20% for a 10-year period, for up to 10 years. 10 years or however many years they've been in the program, 10 years maximum. So that's how the program is intended to work this time. Talk a little bit about, well, let's also take a look. Let's go to page 4. I've created some examples. Actually, probably more examples here than you want to go through at this point in time, but we'll go through one set of them just to give you some feel for how this program works. Look at example 1 on page 4. It says that a property owner currently owns 8 acres of forest land in Clackamas County. Now, I'll say up front that under this particular bill, these people would not be able to take this option. But
because they're under 10 acres.
Because they're under 10 acres. But what I did, just so you can get some idea of what's happening with those smaller landowners, give you the example. So they own 8 acres of forest land. Their taxable value at 100% would be $2,464 at a $10 rate per $1,000 worth of value, which is just a number that's kind of average, say, for Western Oregon, but it is not does not represent any one particular piece of land. So at 100%, they would pay $24.64 worth of property tax on their land. Under this option that we have in front of you today, they would pay on 20% of their value, so that they would pay a property tax of $4.88. The difference between the two then is $19.76. So that's what happens with an 8-acre owner. Let's move on to example two, where that owner owns 50 acres of forest land. I complicated this a little bit, showing you that land, all forest land, is taxed based on its ability to grow timber, on its productivity. So there's productivity values. There are actually 7 of them. So I threw in a couple of extra productivity classes just to show you how this could work with a piece of property. Bottom line, they have 50 acres. At 100% of the taxable value, they would pay $155.66. Under the 20% option, then they would pay $30.88. The remaining, say, $124.78 would be available then for them to, say, reinvest in their forest land or use however they wish. Example three then carries the same kind of productivity split. It's an owner that owns 1,200 acres of land. If you look at the bottom lines here, at 100% of the value, they would pay $3,735.81 worth of tax. If they were under this option then, they would pay $741 worth of tax. The difference being almost $3,000 then that are available to reinvest in their property and do whatever they wish.
Mr. Chair, I think maybe you should say net of any harvest tax they might have.
That's correct. That's correct. Thank you.
And Norm, I guess, too, one thing I want to make clear is that the what's showing is unpaid taxes, not unpaid taxes. Under current law, they wouldn't be paying that tax. I should say, under the current regime, they wouldn't be paying that tax. This would be the tax that would be due if they were to go on to 100% taxation. That is, this isn't tax that's being collected right now that's being foregone.
Sure, federally, that is correct. Right. Yeah, so we'll get into that just a little bit also. So moving then into the tax at harvest. We're calling it the severance tax, which a lot of forest landowners can relate to that because that's an old name that's been used, and we'll continue the use of that name. We'll begin January 1 of 2000 for any harvest after or on or after January 1 of 2004. The tax rates themselves are based on anticipated volume recovery and the relationship between that and the unpaid tax over, say, what is referred to as a rotation age. Rotation age being the length of time from the time that you plant those trees until they're old enough for a harvest. So we look at the volume when they're fully grown, more or less. And then compare that with the dollars of unpaid tax over that period of time also to arrive at a rate. There are different rates for Western Oregon and Eastern Oregon. The primary difference between those and reason for the difference in rates between the two sides of the state is because those two sides of the state employ different measures of volume. So there are different ways to actually measure the volume in Eastern Oregon as compared to Western Oregon. Basically, there's a 25% difference in those volumes. Say Eastern Oregon is 25% higher than Western Oregon. So we kept that idea as we created the rates.
Question?
Sure.
Yeah, excuse me. Eastern Oregon is 25% higher in what? Higher in volume?
Volume, yes.
Yep. Okay.
Follow up on that.
I'm
likely to ask a lot of beginning questions because I don't know this stuff at all. To follow up on that question, so the same tree in Western Oregon would have a different volume than an identical tree in Eastern Oregon. Is that what you're saying?
Chair Shetterly, representing Barnhart, that is correct.
Based purely on the way in which it's measured?
Based purely on the way that it's measured.
Okay. Thank you.
And I do have an explanation in that if the committee wants to really get into the detail of it. But I mean that's current law. That's what we've always measured.
Chair Shetterly, that is correct. Actually, that is our rules created by the scaling bureaus that are employed within the state.
That's not in this bill. That difference between Eastern and Western Oregon, as far as the way we treat.
That's correct.
Kimberly. Okay, then as we move on from one year to the next, the tax rate is established based on the value of that property for, or the taxable value of that property for 2004. What the committee thought then was, as you move it on from one year to the next, as you're going through, say, a 50-year rotation, is that the rate should be indexed from one year that would reflect the change in property value as you move from one year to the next. So there is a mechanism within this particular bill then to index that tax rate annually. And we'll get into the amendments a little later. Repayment of the unpaid tax is not tied to individual taxpayer. This is a concept that can be a little difficult. but it's an important one. It's one that needs to get onto the record. As you take a piece of property, we've made some assumptions about how harvest will take place, assuming that those people will harvest, say, 100% of their timber when it is fully grown. If for some chance an individual landowner decides not to harvest all their timber or has some government restriction that really restricts them from harvesting all their timber, the tax may not be paid on that particular piece of property to the full extent. On the converse, because of the way the tax rate works, it's actually an average tax rate to recover the amount of tax that's unpaid by all landowners. So it doesn't apply to individual productivity classes. The productivity classes each have their own value associated with them, so they're different rates. There's only one harvest tax rate. So it's possible that some people could actually overpay their tax or underpay their tax, just based on that. The average should come out, if we've done our homework properly, that all that 80% is paid at the end of the rotations. So that's a difficult concept, but it's one that actually the Department of Revenue dealt with in a tax court case in 1998, where we had an individual landowner. Let's say this program were to start in 2004, and we have somebody who owns 50 acres of land. Going back to my example, they have not paid $124.78 worth of tax, but when they harvest that timber in 2005, maybe they will have owed, based on the service tax rate, $130. So we're trying to maintain a disconnect between the service tax and the property tax so that landowner can't come back to the court and said, I overpaid my tax, therefore I get that money back. So is that...
Well, I think what we're saying is that in concept, the 80% is designed in the aggregate the service tax is designed to, in the aggregate, statewide, across all owners, to collect the deferred tax. But you're not applying that on a per property by property basis.
Sure, certainly. Thank you. That's correct.
Account by account basis. And I assume part of that is to save administrative expenses, too.
That's exactly what it's for, Mr. Chair. And the other reason is that if we had gone, actually, within the last session, the committee that looked at this looked at ways to tie this to individual pieces of property, then in essence what it looked like was that you're placing a lien against that property. And that was something that the forest landowner community did not really want to do. And then the final point that I have here under earned tax of harvest is one tax rate in Western Oregon aggregates the payments of the unpaid tax, and I think we've pretty much talked about that. Moving on, then looking at the extension of the current tax program for less than 5,000 acre owners. What this will do in extending this out 1 year will allow for education of taxpayers before an April 1 deadline for selection of the option. In other words, April 1 of 2004, they're going to have to select an option based on some really technical calculations that they might have to go through. So this gives time also for us to go out and educate those people on what the choice may be. It allows counties the time to prepare for switching the property tax classification of 41,000 taxpayers and to process those taxpayer options. It allows for development of return processing systems within the Department of Revenue and to process the taxpayer options. The current privilege tax at 3.2% in Western Oregon and 1% in Eastern Oregon, so it's based on value at this point in time, for less than 5,000 owners, will apply to all harvests occurring between January 1 of 2003 and December 31st of 2003. So instead of, say, this bill passes and comes out of and signed by the governor in, say, April, hopefully, then any harvest occurring up to that time still would have to pay the privilege tax on that piece of timber harvested. The last thing, then, would be the Department of Revenue is charged with creating an educational plan and educating all of the forest landowners that are out there. What I've done is kind of outlined what that plan is at this point in time. In essence, what it is that we will send letters out to all 41,000 forest landowners so each one knows that there's a change taking place and what their options might be. Then we're going out and we're using a large group, actually, of people to do some education work. Mainly, we're going to use the resources of OSU Forestry Extension. They're used to training people. They're good at training people. Department of Revenue will be involved in that training, as will the Department of Forestry with service foresters. So we planned on doing that so our forest landowners are educated about their choice. So hopefully, you know, first time around, we get the choices made and move on. The only other thing then that's in front of you, there are two amendments to this bill. The Dash 1 amendment does a couple of things. One, in extending the privilege tax out one more year, the Department of Revenue then is charged with creating stumpage values, which are used to calculate the privilege tax, which we've done for the last 24 years. So this will extend this out one more year. As we were doing that, because you take the large landowners out of the mix, and what we've done over time is when you do an appraisal, which is what this is, you create a target that you're trying to target this appraisal for, you know, a certain type of property, a given type of property. So we've used as our model, as our target model, the large landowner community. You take those people out of the mix, then that changes the target that we're shooting for. So our target becomes a combination of large, small owners. So owners who own a large number of acres, do a fair amount of harvesting, but still own less than 5,000 acres of land. And any industrial company that buys timber from a small owner would have to report based on the stumpage values. So we have to maintain that. In part of the process of doing that, we've already established the values then for 2003. And part of the hearing process that we had for that, there were a couple small landowners that came in and said, well, our costs may be considerably different from the industrial landowners. So we'd like to see a change to that. And rather than go out and do a complete study of small owners and their logging costs, which would be very time-consuming, there's another way of doing that. You could do that within the statute, and that is exclude those landowners who own less than 5,000 acres of land from paying based on the stumpage value, which is what the first two sections of the amendment are trying to do. It would still, the industrial forest landowners then would still have to pay based on the stumpage values. So they are our target. So that would cover really section 62A and 62B, excuse me, then are for western and eastern Oregon. Excuse me, I haven't seen these amendments for very long. Yes, they're for western and eastern Oregon. Then 71B and 71A are a way of the technical change. The index then, according to the bill that you had in front of you, the original 2197 said the indexing would start in 2006. The intention of the committee that worked on this was for that to start in 2005. So that's just kind of a housekeeping type of change to move it in line with what the committee wanted. With that, do you have any questions? I'm sure there'll be a few.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I'm a little foggy on how the indexing part of that works. How would that work if someone logged a small portion each year they have left the bank, as it were? How does the indexing factor in those harvests? Is it, you know?
Chair Federally, representing Haas, let's go through page 7 of the examples that I came up with. I kind of skipped over this piece to it. First thing I'd like to show you in the top part of the page is how the index would work. In essence, what it is, if you compare the average forest land value then for 2004-2005 with the average forest land value for 2005-2006, the difference is a 2.93% increase from one year to the next. Well, and that we'll deal with in amendment also. So at this point in time, you would increase the tax due at harvest, the severance tax rate, you would increase it by 2.93% for the year, any harvest occurring in 2005. So how this would work then, if you go down to the bottom half of the page, you have a landowner then that owns 50 acres of land in Douglas County. This person opts into the small tract forest land option in 2004. A harvest takes place in 2007 in which 65,000 board feet of timber is harvested, and this is all the timber from about 3 acres of their land. So in 2004, 05, 06, and 07, they would pay, based on 20%, $60.88 on their land. Based on what they've harvested, then, the tax not paid is $243.50. If you look at a little bit to the right, it says tax rate indexing. This will show you how the tax rate will be indexed over this period of time that we're talking, the 04 through 07. So the tax rate in 2007 would be $4.25 per 1,000 board feet times the number of board feet harvested. They would actually pay $276.25 worth of tax. The difference then between the two is they've actually paid $32.75 more in severance tax than they have not paid on their property.
Well, is that though just a way to capture the time value of the deferred property tax?
It's more a timing in when the harvest takes place. You know, we've set the rate to capture over a 50-year period, assuming somebody's planting 2004 and then 50 years. But in this particular case, an individual had older timber, and so they were able to harvest that sooner. So yes, it is. It has something to do with the time value of money. Yes.
Yes, Representative Bridger.
It seems to me that it looks complicated, but basically, let me see if I can just kind of capsule what you're trying to do here, and that is to be sure that the small forest land owner pays taxes in the way that he's responsible, or she is responsible for paying to the state. In other words, we want to be sure that the right amount of taxes are collected for the state, for the revenue. But in order for them to do that, and since they don't have the money that can pay those taxes, because they don't harvest every year, you're trying to set up a system whereby when they cut the trees, at that time they would pay the taxes. Now, am I oversimplifying it?
Chair Shetterly, Representative Berger, you have captured the essence of the bill. There are some nuances, I think, that you'll see. You'll see with the revenue impact that you'll receive to it. You'll see some minor differences to that, but overall, that's what we're trying to do. Yes,
Representative Berger.
Yeah, I'm sure glad you simplified this. That was just a comment. excuse me, Representative. The indexing then is a way of encouraging as Representative Haas indicated, I'm not sure what the indexing does. In the example that you've given, it hurt the example in terms of he pays more tax or more tax is paid ultimately. Why is it $4? What is the thing that makes the $4.25 on that year and the $4.13 in that year? What is that based on? That's what I don't understand. What its index is based on?
Sure, Chevrolet, Representative Berger. What we're trying to do is capture unpaid tax over this 50-year period of time. As you go through this 50-year period, then the tax on that piece of property will increase. With a tax based on just volume, there's no mechanism built into the tax itself to increase that over time to be able to recapture the tax that really is unpaid. Of the particular example that I threw out, and I threw it out for a reason, just so you can see what might happen, is there are some landowners who will have older timber, may harvest their timber earlier. Actually, this is incentive. If I were looking at this example as a landowner, I was very seriously considering staying in the 100% forest land program, paying all of my property taxes annually, so that when I harvested my timber, I would not have to pay more severance tax than I'd actually not paid in my property tax. So those lead to some of the options that forest land owners have over time.
Mr. Chair?
Let me give follow-up.
Okay.
Yeah.
You explained this earlier, and I said I'll wait until I've heard more and see if I could understand this. You indicated that a property owner could go onto this plan, then come off of this plan, and then go back on this plan. Did I understand that correctly?
Chair Shetley, Representative Berger, that is correct. That's how the current bill is set up, so that they can go in and out of the program, say on an annual basis, if they so chose to do that. The concern there is that you might have people who could use the system to keep from paying their property taxes over time. And that's one of the reasons why there is a penalty, call it penalty, that's built in the process that says that if within a 10-year period you come out of the system, then you pay that unpaid property tax, the entire amount of it. As you move over that 10-year period, say if I'm in the program for 15 years and I choose to get out of the program, then there's a certain portion of the property tax that wasn't paid that will not be recovered.
Okay.
Other questions down here? Representative Scott.
Your 2.93 factor of the 04, 05, 05, 06, I got that example, but then if you carry it on down to your harvest example, I think I follow it there. Now the question arises that if you go into it for the 10-year period of time, does the factor accumulate deferral interest or deferral percentages or something to... where I'm headed is if a person doesn't harvest for 10 years, okay, you have the history of what that is, but can you project anything in the future as to what it's going to be before the harvest time?
Chair Shetterly, Representative Scott, at this point in time, we're really not building any kind of mechanism to, say, pay interest on unpaid tax at this point in time? Was that the question?
It is the question. Then a follow-up to that.
Yes, sure. Mm-hmm.
So then if a person doesn't harvest for 10 years and sells their land but never opts out of the program, what happens?
Sure, should I represent it, Scott? The program then will follow along with the taxation option will follow with the land unless an owner that owns, say, more than 5,000 acres purchases that land. But let's say it is a smaller landowner. The option then carries on until somebody actually opts out of the program.
So it's for life with it until harvested.
Representative Scott, that's correct.
Unless they withdraw it, in which case then they pay
then
the
taxes. Then they pay the taxes,
yeah.
Right.
Representative Hans?
Well, thank you. I was going to the same place, and in the seniors' deferral program, there's a 6% interest rate. I think it's 6, maybe it's 8. And is this what you're trying to do here? Is that the same sort of function?
Sure, certainly, Representative Haas. There are some similarities to the senior deferral system, and you're correct that the interest rate for senior deferral is 6% simple interest. In this particular case, the committee did not factor interest into any of the calculations, so what you're doing is you're just accumulating tax without interest over time.
But at an escalating rate being adjusted by this index.
Sure, that's correct, yes.
So interest would make it... What was the decision for no interest rate?
Well, for one thing, as I understand it, since this is not being taxed, this is not being collected on a per property basis, you don't have any amount that you can actually attach interest to. That's correct.
So
you can assign an amount that you're calculating interest on. So this just seems to keep the aggregate moving up at that index rate.
Chair Shirley, yes, that's correct. The other thing I would suggest for the committee is that maybe staff would have some information when you go into work session about how the rate was computed, so you get a better feel for how that works.
Okay. Before I get to Representative Barnett,
I just want to make one comment, Chair. It might help the committee members, and that is the indexing of the harvest tax rate. Conceptually matches the indexing of the maximum assessed value under the property tax system. So under the property tax system, you have value increasing at 3% per year, at least. And under the harvest taxes, from the basis, doesn't increase. Volume is still measured as volume, and there's no real... One could argue, I think, that maybe you'll get better management if you have this system, and so volume might grow a little bit. But generally, volume is fixed. So if the harvest rate is fixed and volume is fixed, there's no growth in that tax structure. Mm-hmm. But there is growth in the property tax, and you're trying to replace 80% of the property tax with this system. So that's why the growth is growing.
Okay, that makes sense. Representative Barnhart?
I'm still trying to get into my head what the connections are between the property tax not paid and the severance tax. So I have several questions, really, that I think are related to that question. Let's suppose that I'm a guy who's got some forest land, and I have just planted, within the last couple of years, a bunch of Douglas fir trees, and they're going to take another 50 years to mature. I'd be kind of nuts not to take this program, wouldn't I? Because I'm going to get to not pay 80% of my taxes, and then I'm going to pay a severance tax, or my descendants will, my heirs 50 years from now, based on the severance tax, which will recover a great deal less at that point than the amount of the unpaid property tax, won't they? If I run that thing out all the way for 50 years?
Well, I guess whether, you know, let me just, whether you recover more or less is going to depend on your particular property, but statewide...
It'll be a great deal less, won't it?
I don't think so.
Chair Shuttle, the Representative Barnhart, the way the tax rate was computed mm-hmm. was that so if in that, which is the most pure situation that you have right now,
right.
over that 50-year time, it's computed that you would actually pay the unpaid tax based on the tax rate. There are a lot of other variations to that. Let's say your timber was 20 years old now and you're going out 30 years. So there's some other variations that would make your choice a little bit different. And that's based on the age of your timber and the amount of tax that you would defer over that time. I think there's some opportunity there to get into some of those questions with some information that staff has put together.
Well, let me ask a different question, sure. then, because this may answer it for me. If I pay a severance tax on a piece of land on some trees that I harvest from a piece of land, does that then start the severance tax rate over again, back at the $3.89, or does it continue to grow at this rate that you've got on there?
Chair Shadley, Representative Barnhart, that rate will continue to grow over time for all landowners. So if in your case you were to harvest the timber and start over, let's say a fire came in, uh-huh. wiped out all your timber, you'd be starting over your plantation, and the tax rate then would act, since it's trying to recover the property tax that's being unpaid at all that time, since it has increased, say, over this 10-year period, and will continue as you go on, the tax rate does not start over for each individual landowner. It just continues to increase at the same rate as the property tax in property tax value increases.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, I haven't done the arithmetic on this, but it probably doesn't work the way I'm thinking it does, but it's hard for me to understand how unpaid taxes on an annual basis are somehow made up for by a single tax rate on severance, which is based on a valuation increase only. Those things simply don't hang together over time. I admit the example here works, but when you run it out many more years, I don't see how it possibly could work. I'm obviously missing something in my understanding of the arithmetic, and maybe we'll get to that with the staff analysis.
Well, let's go ahead and see if we do, and then we can come back to that if we need some further clarification. Any other questions right now for Mr. Miller? All right. Are you done with your testimony then?
Mr. Chair, I'm done.
All right. Wally Rutledge, did you...
I'll just take a few moments. Chair Terry, for the record, my name is Wallace Rutledge. I'm the Director of Forestry Assistance for the Department of Forestry. I believe all of you received a copy of this report.
Yes.
This is a report that the committee put together. Since you have a copy and you had a chance maybe to look at it a little bit, I won't go into very much detail, but I'd like to highlight just a few things from the report. One of the things, we talked about small woodland owners, and there was some testimony earlier that talked about not harvesting annually, and they didn't have the funding to pay for their taxes on an annual basis. There's a few other things that actually impact for small tract forest landowners differently than they do the large landowners. And one of those is because they're working with smaller tracts of forest land, it generally costs more to manage because they can't achieve economy of scale that the large landowner can do. And also we find that in many cases, small tract forest landowners may be impacted a whole lot more by regulations such as riparian buffer strips and sensitive wildlife sites than the large landowners. A good example is if a landowner has 40 acres and there's a spotted owl next to it, he may not be able to harvest any of that 40 acres. He may be restricted from cutting half of that. Whereas a large landowner, that spotted owl may only affect a small percentage of that particular landowner. Another one that I think was mentioned earlier is that small tract landowners are generally responsible for estate taxes, and corporate landowners don't have to deal with estate taxes at all. There's also a difficulty in marketing forest products. If you have a small volume, you can expect to get the same price maybe as if you have a large volume that you can deliver to a mill over many years. There are also a lot of small landowners like to grow larger trees, and we're finding right now that there's a penalty at the mill for growing large trees. And so that's a difficult thing for the small landowners. Can I continue to grow my trees large if I'm going to get penalized when I take them to the mill? Also, they have some other non-traditional, especially wood commodities, that they find sometimes a hard place to market. For example, oak. It's difficult to find a market for oak and so forth. So these are some of the things that may impact the small tract landowner that doesn't impact those larger landowners, and that's one of the things that we talked about, that these tax programs don't actually fit the both elements of the forest landowners. A couple of other things that we talked about. The minimum acreage, we talked about that a little bit. The committee felt like that by eliminating the people that own less than 10 acres, it doesn't put a very heavy tax burden at all on those landowners. As you notice in Norm's example, I think the total tax bill for 8 acres was $30. Most of those landowners actually have another job. They don't depend upon their forest land to pay their taxes. So the committee didn't feel like it was a real tax burden for that landowner to pay a $30 annual tax. Also, there's a lot of those landowners, and they don't really understand how to fill out timber tax forms. They create a lot of mistakes. And so by eliminating those smaller landowners from this program, it really greatly reduces administrative costs without putting the real burden of paying high taxes on those landowners. Another thing is that the group really wanted to develop what they call a conservation option. And they developed one that would give landowners a 50% reduction in their taxes if they actually implemented some conservation practices that were above and beyond what the law requires. That was floated around, and we couldn't get total agreement from all of the affected parties. And so that particular option was referred to another conservation work group established by House Bill 3564. That group is working on that, and I believe that they are going to bring something to you in the form of an income tax credit that you may see later on in the session. So I think the other thing I might point out is that in terms of a revenue impact to the Department of Forestry, there will be about $500,000 saving, $494,630 savings to the department because of the elimination of the Western Oregon Small Tract Optional Tax. Now that's being taken right now. And what the department would like to do then is to use $255,934.28 FTEs of this savings in order to fulfill a responsibility on ORS 321-367. Now that statute requires the state forester to go out and look at underproducing land and work with that landowner to get that land back productive. If that landowner fails to do that within a year or fails to start to implement a plan within a year, then the state forester recommends to the assessor that they declassify that land from the special forest valuation so that then that landowner pays, probably in a lot of cases with small tracts, a higher land value than especially assessed forest value. So with that, I'd just like to summarize by saying that what we've attempted to do here in House Bill 2197 is to create a streamlined version of two tax programs into one tax program and make it so that landowners are encouraged and can willingly invest their money into managing small tract optional or small tract forest lands. And then I would like to encourage the group to pass House Bill 2197 with these dash 1 and 2 amendments on out of committee with a due pass recommendation. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions for Mr. Rutledge? All right. Thank you very much, you two. I just wanted to ask.
They said they would like to come in.
Okay. Would you rather defer your further comments until after we get the staff slideshow?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. For the record, again, Christina McNitt with Small Woodlands. Whatever is the committee's pleasure, I just think there's some discussions here. I feel really lucky to have Clint Benz here on my left, because there are some pretty complicated assumptions that are going into these formulas and this issue. And as you can tell, I think maybe you have a better understanding now of why it took almost 5 years to get here. And these really were small woodland owners and county assessors and people sitting at a table for two successive interim groups, and it was a lot of work and information to get their hands around. So Clint is the expert and may be able to clarify some of the questions the committee has.
Do you want to take a stab now, or would you rather wait until we have our staff overview? If you've got some things you want to clarify now, I'd be happy to hear from you.
Yeah, Chair Shirley, there was one issue that maybe we could clarify now, and then would like to have the ability to chat after Mr. Yates has done his work. And that was the issue Representative Barnhart had on the tax rate. In our discussion, the tax rate is indexed every year, and it increases basically 3% a year, assuming that the land values will go up on the Measure 50 limitation. At the time of harvest, all the harvest is occurring at that highest tax rate. So say you were 50 years down the road, you're harvesting, you're going to be paying it, let's say it's $13 a thousand. What that $13 a thousand does, because you deferred tax back in 2004 at $3.89 a thousand in effect, and now you're paying all your tax at $13 a thousand. You figure that's, you know, there's a 3% compound growth rate in the tax rate, which is in effect a 6% simple interest deferral over the rotation. And so we felt that this indexing in effect mimicked collecting interest. So you're basically, even though you deferred the tax at $3, you're paying it at $13, and so that in effect what you're doing is you're paying the interest as well. I mean, there's not, when we came up with this $3.89 number, there was a lot of time value of money, projecting forward, doing some assumptions as to who was going to harvest and how many board feed, and there's a lot of numbers that went into that $3.89, and one of those was this assumption that when you pay the assumption at that time, then you not only would pay all the tax you deferred, but all the tax you deferred plus an interest component is part of that computation. It works out that way in the numbers.
And, you know, it's interesting. My recollection, first of all, this is intended to mimic the severance tax that was on the books for all landowners prior to 1999. In my recollection, Representative Barnett, one of the bugaboos about the severance tax is that while it was, I think, explicitly set in statute as being intended to collect that deferred tax, it was actually collecting more than the deferred tax. So in the aggregate, on a statewide basis, it was collecting more than the tax that was actually being deferred by the property tax. So my recollection
that's
right.
Correct. In fact, it was collecting significantly more than what was being deferred, which is why the large landowners
wanted out.
Yeah. In addition, as far as the department is concerned, as of today, there is no deferred tax. So we're starting today with a clean slate. Because of how much tax was collected under the old system, basically the feeling there is no deferred tax in property. So we're starting with a clean slate today going forward at 100%. And so, in effect, people that do harvest early in this program, if they clear cut, they'll be paying a penalty. However, I think one of the things Dick is going to talk about is his assumptions on how many people will opt into this program. Something to remember about small landowners, they're different from the industrial landowners in that this is not all a dollars and cents issue for them. This is really an issue of flexibility. Now, we on our land, we own 700 acres. We do harvest something every year. We're currently harvesting less than what is growing on the property every year. But by electing this program, for me, if I'm harvesting on a sustained basis, I'm paying the same tax under the 100% program or under this 2080 program, so it's a push. But if I come to a year when I don't want to do a harvest, then I don't have to pay tax that year. If I then increase my harvest in a future year, then I'll pay more. But over time, I'm basically paying the same amount of tax in either program. This is a no-brainer for me on my land to do this because it gives me flexibility to pay the tax when I have the money. And I think we've got, I think, an assumption here that 41% of the eligible people will opt in. My feeling, that's a very worst-case scenario. I would be, frankly, very disappointed if that number is not significantly in excess of that that opt-in rate. And Dick will chat about his assumptions and why he came up with that number.
You've got the logarithm to show.
I'm not going to do that. Yeah. There, but I won't do that.
That's the only reason I came.
Well, I thought it was especially pertinent to speak of a logarithm when we're talking about
Very good.
Representative Barnhart.
Just a quick question. The last three sentences you used, are you saying you expect the opt-in to be higher or lower?
I'm expecting an 80% opt-in
to this program. To be higher.
I expect it to be much higher than what is in the revenue impact number, which will make the revenue impact much less. The more people are in the system, the more dollars are going to be in the system in terms of harvest. What he's assuming is that people that are going to harvest early are not going to come into the program.
Right.
And my assumption is they will come into the program because it gives them flexibility. Unless it's just small landowners, if I only have 20 acres and I'm going to clear cut it next year, I'm not going to opt in. But if I'm harvesting on a sustained basis, which most of our landowners are, all this program gives me is flexibility, and I'm going to opt in because I'm going to, in effect, pay the same amount of tax irregardless.
Well, one last question. The way the proposal is drafted, could you clear cut your land next year and opt in the year after?
Yes.
Okay. So eventually, most people will opt in.
Yes.
Probably.
Everybody. I think everybody that can opt in will. The question is, some people may delay for a period of time. The hard part is that we were looking at how much tax is deferred over a rotation. Mm-hmm. But when you're doing your budgeting, you have to do it, in 2-year slices. And so in any 2-year slice, the number may be lower or higher, depending on how many people decide to harvest, which with small landowners, the large landowners, you look at their harvest rates and they're level. Every year they harvest the same amount. Small landowners, the harvest rates go like this because it's driven by price and by fear of regulation. Something new is coming down the road, you'll see a lot of young timber go down the road because they think, well, I'm not going to be able to harvest it. But price and fear are the two driving factors for most small landowners on harvest. So you're not going to see that same pattern that you see with the large landowners.
I'm sorry. I do have one more question. We're switching from a system in which the severance tax is based on the value of the timber to a system based on the volume of the timber.
Mm-hmm.
What impact do you expect that to have on the issues you were just talking about, fear and greed?
Fear and greed.
That's the wrong word.
Yes,
I'm sorry.
Fear
and price.
And price, yes. That's a better term. We looked at volume, and the reality is that if somebody's on the current 2080 program, these tax rates are significantly less than what the 3.2% or the 1.8% value tax is today. It's going to be a penalty for people who are taking out lower value wood, but typically that lower value wood is the early wood that comes off the property, and in terms of volume, it's much less than the volume you experience at final harvest. And so even though the tax rate as a percentage is going to be higher compared to the value of that wood, the overall volumes of that low-quality wood that comes out of the woods is smaller. The big volume is at the end of the rotation.
Okay.
Which is your high value wood.
So what you're saying, I think, is that this evaluation system will encourage higher value.
Absolutely.
Production.
Absolutely.
Okay. Yeah. I'm sorry.
No, good question.
But it's beginning to get through.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's good stuff. I tell you what, let's stay in hearing, Dick, to go to yours, and that way then we can be flexible about easier about bringing folks up to comment or ask about that. Christina, did you have anything else?
No.
Okay, why don't you go ahead and retire to your seats, and Dick, if you'd take us through your slideshow.
Just briefly to note the materials you have now just passed out a fiscal analysis on the bill. You have my staff measure summary and revenue impact statement. And you should also have a copy of some slides, and I'll go through those at this point.
Okay.
What I want to do here is to just sort of familiarize you basically with the bill, because it is some 129 sections, and sort of make sure you understand what's in it, basically. As commented here, there are two major parts of the bill. The first is to extend the existing program, which allows owners to pay property tax on 20% of the value and then pay a privilege tax at 3.2% in the west, 1.8% in the east, on the value of any timber harvested. So it extends that program for 1 year. And the next thing it does is to create a new program, which will then be effective in 2004. And those are the two major provisions. The rest of the bill, we have four captions essentially in the bill. Disqualifications, sections 19 to 53. Administration of the severance tax, sections 54 to 62. Conforming amendments in sections 63 to 74. And then the repeal of the small tract option tax. That small tract option tax is really gone now. There's no lands that are currently assessed under that program, and this is just a getting rid of the statutes that used to apply to those lands.
Maybe just for a committee of the WO of Western Oregon?
That's correct. And then the last section is miscellaneous, and we'll look at each of those. Extension of the program, current law, the privilege tax has sunsetted already, is essentially gone as of January 1, 2003, this year. And as of the upcoming tax year for property tax purposes, all forest land will be on at 100%. That's where it sits right now if you do nothing. What this bill does is a one-year extension, so that privilege tax is continued during calendar year 2003. So for this year, including back to January 1, even if, you know, this bill becomes effective in October, back through January 1, they'll pay severance taxes on any harvest from that land. And for the upcoming property tax years, 2003-2004, they will be assessed at 20% rather than 100%. Thereafter, they have two choices. One is to go on to the 100% program to be treated like large owners, or to apply and qualify for assessment as for small tract forest land. And if you're interested in looking at those, the bill sections are there for you. Small tract forest land, there's a number of slides here on just quickly where they are. Property tax relates to Section 7. The severance tax in Section 9, the application process in Section 3, the requirements that the land and the landowner must meet to qualify, certain notifications that the owners have to make to the assessor, the disqualification. Now, we saw a major section on disqualifications, and that's sort of just amending sections that already exist for farmland, forest land, and so on. This is a new section, essentially, which relates to disqualification under this program. And given that you do are disqualified from the small tract option, then there's an additional tax. They're talking about penalty. The penalty essentially is the additional tax. That's in Section 31. Severance tax administration is in Sections 10, 11, and 12. and the severance tax distribution in sections 13 and 14. Now, I have a slide for each one of these, so we'll go through them quickly. A lot of this is reviewing what the witnesses have testified already. Basically, you have the property tax, and basically this is just like any other property. You have a local tax rate which applies to the value of that property. What's different is the assessed value. So AV again throughout here, rather than spelling everything out, you've got assessed value, specially assessed value, maximum assessed value, and I'm using the asterisks behind it to indicate that it's value in this small tract option program, small tract forest land program. I'm going to have trouble because we're eliminating a Western Oregon small tract option program and creating a small tract forest land program. So I may misspeak from time to time. Anyway, you apply that tax rate to assessed value as it's defined for this program. And the bill does define that. It defines assessed value in this program as the lesser of its specially assessed value in this program or its maximum assessed value in this program. Hmm. All right? So far, I haven't told you anything. So we first define those. Specially assessed value in this program is 20% of the value determined by the Department of Revenue for highest and best use forest land. All right, and that's the values that apply in the large owner program. So the department is charged with every year coming up with assessed values, and they have models to essentially do that. And so they determine the specially assessed value of forest land, and in this program, the specially assessed value is 20% of that. You move to maximum assessed value, and this program then is defined as the same as the greater of. I use max function there, but it says the greater of 103% of its assessed value last year or its maximum assessed value in this program last year.
Well, and that's is this where this mimics Measure 50.
It's exactly the same wording in Measure 50. The only difference is if you're talking about a home,
right,
the assessed value is the value of the home. Right. Here it's the specially assessed value as forest land. So it's the same thing. Now, as you have every time you change programs, you create a new program, you have a little bit of trouble defining exactly, well, you don't have any trouble defining what maximum assessed value is, you just don't know the number because it doesn't exist because you've got a new program out there. So what the bill does is the same way the large owner program was entered, with a new set of maximum values for the first year of the program. This does the same thing, and those appear in Section 8, starting with $62 or something like that. But they're basically 20% of the values for the large owner program, starting with $92, yeah, given a one-year indexing at 3%. So they correlate pretty closely. They are truncated, but they're pretty much the same.
So again, unlike residential property tax, these tax values are established by statute.
Yes.
Yeah.
Moving to the severance tax, then, were there any questions on property? Okay. The severance tax, again, the same sort of format. You have a tax rate which is applied to some base, and the base is the volume harvested in each calendar year. And you measure volume in terms of 1,000 board feet of product of wood harvesting. And that volume then is subject to a rate. The rate is set for the first year of the bill, 2004, calendar year, at 3.89 in the west and 3.03 in the east. And that rate is indexed annually. The bill says 2006. There's an amendment to make that 2005 so that it would index immediately right after the first year. The index, the way the index is computed is you take the average for some base year, say the first year of the program, which would be 2005, you take the average value of forest land in that year and divide it by the average value of forest land in the prior year. Now, if it's eastern Oregon, you just use all forest land, and if it's Western Oregon, you take the average over the eight site classes that exist in Western Oregon and divide those by 8, so you get an average value. Now, I have a problem with this, and so you have an amendment which will change that, and the way it'll change it is to put asterisks in here, essentially, and that is make the index a function of the values of the land in the program, as opposed to all land in Western Oregon or Eastern Oregon.
Oh, no.
The reason for that is when you start taking land which is on at 100% and land which is on at 20% and you start averaging those, you get funny numbers when there's any sort of movement back and forth between those programs. And you get exactly the same. I think you get what you want in concept by just tying it to the land that actually enters the small tract forest land program. So those are the two issues that are at the bottom. One is when the indexing starts, and the other is whether you use assessed value or assessed value in the forest land, in the small tract forest land program. And those are in the amendments. Those issues are addressed in the amendments. The application process to apply, the owner of small tract forest land has to apply to each assessor. Generally, that would just be an assessor if his forest land is all in one county. If it's in more than one county, he has to apply to all of the counties that are involved. He applies on forms prescribed by the Department of Revenue, and a little bit of this section does define the minimum content of those forms so that the department gets the types of information it will need. But it also allows the department by rule to essentially ask for any information it needs to run the program. The application is by April 1st, and what that does is to qualify the land retrospectively for a harvest tax back to January 1, and then prospectively for July 1, the property tax year coming up as of July 1. If the application is denied by the assessor, it specifies notice that the assessor must make in appeal processes for the taxpayer. If it's qualified, the assessor has to send a notice plus a copy of the application to the Department of Revenue, and that's where the department gets the information to sort of oversee this plan and also to administer the severance tax program. Requirements to qualify, it's already been noted that this the individual, the common ownership of an individual who's making an application here has to be at least 10 acres of forest land and not more than 5,000 acres of forest land. The bill does address the definition there of common ownership in Section 1, where it's talking about that can be through a partnership, through a corporation, or whatever, if the individual is a majority interest holder in that business organization. That counts. The land owned by that partnership or corporation counts as part of his common ownership. The application, there's been a little bit of talk about people choosing, opting in and opting out. This section limits it a little bit in the sense that they cannot choose a portion of their ownership within a tax lot and qualify that. They are limited to all forest land within a tax lot would have to be applied for uniformly, either in or out of the program. It's also true if you hold forest land in a contiguous parcel, which just means there is a boundary, more than a point between the two pieces of property, so that all land, all forest land within a contiguous parcel must also be part of an application. You can't pick and choose. The other thing is that the property must meet minimum stocking and specie requirements, and the bill says that that will be determined by the Department of Revenue by rule. And Mr. Rutledge was talking about the activities, I think, of the Forestry Department. Part of that is going to be involved in determining whether lands meet this requirement, and also once they're in the program, making sure they continue to meet this. Once an owner is in the program, then if any of these things occur, they're required to give notice to the assessor. and that is if they acquire new forest land, which would be contiguous to something they've already applied for and it has already been qualified under the small tract forest land program. So if they add something which is now contiguous, then in a sense not all contiguous acreage is in. So what would happen here probably is that the land would be disqualified and then immediately requalified, including that portion that they picked up. And in that case, there would not be an additional tax. Again, if the ownership, if he acquires new land and total ownership of the owner exceeds 5,000 acres, he has to notify the assessor. Or if he sells off a piece and his ownership falls below 10 acres, he has to notify the assessor. And if there's a change so that the land is being used for a non-forest use, notification is required. Again, the assessor forwards these notifications to the Department of Revenue, and the assessor may, and the operative word at this point I think is may, disqualify simply for failure to notify. In other words, if the assessor discovers one of these changes has occurred, has not been notified, he may disqualify the land. Now, actions that the assessor has to disqualify the land, a request by the owner to have it disqualified, sale to an exempt owner, discovery that the land is not being used as forest land, common ownership exceeds those limits on interest. In other words, it's either less than 10 acres or more than 5,000.
Madam Chair. Or Mr. Chair.
Yes.
What would an example of an exempt owner be?
A sale to a state government, say.
Okay.
So that the government is not going to be paying property tax. Sale to a non-profit, whatever they are, I forget. Subchapter.
Entity?
Conservation district?
Yes, yes. Now, there's a lot of special provisions in here that deal with some of those issues. But in general, if the subsequent owner is not going to be subject to the property tax, then this is disqualified and the additional tax imposed before the sale occurs.
So there are no special exemptions then? Just kind of the normal exemptions that one would expect?
Yes.
Thank you.
Again, if the stocking and species requirements are not met, the assessor must, and in general, this is notification by the Department of Forestry that this occurs. Could be discovery by the assessor as well. If the land is qualified for other MSA, again, I'm sorry for some of these abbreviations, but for some other special assessment program. And in order to qualify, of course, the owner has to make an application, say, to be assessed as farmland. And if that application then is qualified and accepted, then he's qualified for that program. He can't be special assessed in two. He's disqualified under this program. Also, if you happen to record a subdivision plat, that immediately disqualifies the special assessment. Penalty. Each year that you're in the small tract forest land program, up to 10 years, you compute the difference in the property tax between the 100% program and the small tract forest land program. And then the additional tax is the sum of those annual amounts up to the 10 years. So it's the number of years you're actually in the program. If you're only in 5 years, it would be the sum of the first 5 years. If you're in 15 years, it would be the sum of the first, the last 10 years.
Question?
Yes.
So if it, using that example, then the 5 years it would be dropped and were given, so to speak.
If you were disqualified at the end of 5 years.
Well, you're about 15 years.
Oh, yes.
15
yes.
years.
That's correct. That's correct. The issue I have at the bottom here, we'll try to get at later, and I hope we have luck with doing that with an Excel spreadsheet. But anyway, the question is this penalty sufficient to avoid people exiting the program in the year prior to a major harvest and thereby avoiding the harvest tax and then opting back into the program later? So we'll look at that. Severance Tax Administration, this is by the Department of Revenue. They have a responsibility, and this is a temporary Section 18, which requires them to go out ahead of time now and notify whoever they think might qualify for this program that exists and try to tell them what some of the benefits or disadvantages, I guess, exist with the program. Then you have the Department of Forestry issuing notification of operations, essentially any time somebody walks into the forest with a chainsaw. And that is essentially a notice of who's out there cutting timber. And that goes to the, a copy of that goes to the Department of Revenue. And the department is required to monitor those, and it's this which is the source of who they think should be reporting taxes. If anybody out there is in the small tract program and they've got a notification of operations that they were operating on those properties, then the department will mail that owner a return. And that owner must file that return, whether he's harvested or not. Of course, if he hasn't harvested, he just says nothing harvested on the return. But the return must come back to the department. So they have a tracking then of everybody that's cutting out there that owns, that is in the small tract option, small tract forest land program, and they get returns back from all of those people. Or at least they know who to go look for. The other temporary provision here is a report. The department must report back to the legislature by February of 2009 as to how this program is working, and in particular how the harvest rate is doing in terms of capturing the deferred property tax. Again, the reports by the owners is that they only report calendar on a, for a full calendar year. There's no estimated tax. There's no quarterly payments. They report in January how much they harvested the previous calendar year, and when they report that, they pay the tax. An interesting provision there, if the tax is less than $10, forget it. Severance tax distribution. The bill sets up two new funds. We have in current law a Western Oregon timber tax account. That goes away, is repealed. And we have in place a Western Oregon Timber Tax Fund. So that change occurs, and the same thing in Eastern Oregon. What happens is that net of refunds, the severance taxes go into these accounts. Then you take out Department of Revenue administrative expense, and the balance is distributed 60.5% to the state school fund in May, 4.5% to the community college supports fund in May, and then 35% after the end of the fiscal year, August 15th, to the counties. And that's based on the share of assessed value in the small tract forest land program, and it is goes into the county general fund. Disqualifications. Again, there's a lot of sections here, but basically what you're doing is making minor changes to existing law. The first three sort of concepts deal with whether or not a disqualification occurs or when it's important, how you calculate the additional tax, and whether there's a deferral of the additional tax. So you got four sections actually dealing with, say, one idea here is, first you have to delete the fact that the Western Oregon small tract option tax is no longer there. So you take that out. Then you have an effective date section, which says what the effective date of that is, which is July 1, 2003. Then the next section adds this new program back in as of the July 1, 2004. So there's a lot of bill sections, but they're not covering a lot of ideas. Section 34 to 54, then you're dealing with notification in special circumstances, and again, the same sort of routine as you go through those sections. Deleting MoSTOT and adding the small tract forest land program. Severance tax administration. Again, all you're doing here is adding the small tract forest land program to a number of existing programs which call for notification, audit, allow the department to audit, to issue warrants, to assess tax upon failure to file, deal with disclosure provisions. Conforming amendments, The first one in Section 63 deals with the Western Oregon timber tax account, and that's only going to be there for one more year. But what this does is allow forestry, it takes out the provision that, allowed forestry to cover the administrative expense of the small tract option tax, and substitutes in Section 387, I think it was, that Mr. Rutledge referred to, which allows them to cover some of the costs, Section 367, 321, 367, in the forest land management program. Then you also have, for the privilege tax, which again only goes one more year, it's just some changes in the dates from May 15th to May 1st, so that it's more timely in terms of the ability to get the money to the schools when they need it. Then you have a changing here. Current law required the Department of Revenue to determine ownerships in acreages of 5,000 and over, and correspondingly for ownerships less than 5,000 acres. And that was a one-shot deal. What this bill requires is that the department do it every year. And it also, before it was 5,000 acres east side, 5,000 acres west side, it now changes that threshold to 5,000 acres statewide. And then there's just there's some provisions in there, repeals, which were from the maximum on the large owner program going from 75% to 100% of transition provisions. Then the sections on the repeal of WOSTOT, you've actually repealed 16 sections, and then you've got 13 sections that are amended, either to note that you repealed other sections that are referenced, or to delete WOSTOT, or to add the small tract forest land. And some examples there are when you have a dwelling on the land, again, conservation policy or conservation plans, when the land is used for the growing of hardwoods or when it's repairing the land. The miscellaneous section there, the only thing it does is to change one reference in there, which you essentially the bill amends by sticking something in front of it and changing its number. So the technical issues then that we need to, or that the committee might want to think about, Norm Miller raised the, or talked about the First Amendment, which is allowing the use of net stumpage recovery as a basis for determining value for the privilege taxes, which continue now for one more year. And so that's part of the amendments. The other thing is the indexing, and again, moving that up to start in 2005 rather than 2006.
We've got amendments covering that too.
And those are on the same amendments, yes. And then the other issue with respect to the indexing is whether you want to use assessed value in all of Western Oregon and all of Eastern Oregon, or assessed value within this program. And that's the dash two amendments. And the last question was gaming the system, and what I hope I can do here is bring up an Excel spreadsheet which will allow us to look at that question a little bit. Yeah, let's see if I can increase this to 125, because it's a little bit small, I think, on the screen.
Here it is.
Okay, that's better. What I've done here, again, Excel is nice because you can change things and it recalculates everything almost instantly. So what I have is kind of a table at the top here, which is a choice of what I want to look at as a piece of property. And so I've chosen site class FD in Western Oregon, which is sort of toward the lower end. You're running from FA down through FG, essentially, as actual productive forest land. It then calls up the rotation age of that particular site class, which in case of FD is 60 years. And it calls up the yield, which is 36.1 thousand board feet when you harvest an acre of FD land. And it also calls up the assessed value under the 100% program in 2003 and the Table 8 values in statute in this law, in this act, for small tract forest land program. And the purpose of this is to compute the penalty, the tax, the deferred tax, look at the harvest tax, and ask the question, essentially, will the person opt out of this program to avoid the harvest tax? So the difference between the assessed value times the tax rate is the deferred tax. So if I take a $10 per thousand tax rate and apply it essentially to a $210 difference between an assessed value of 261 and assessed value of 52, I get $2.10 an acre. And I'm using an example here of 100 acres. I can change that, in which case the deferred tax will go up if you make it more acres. So in this case, the annual tax deferred is $210 in the first year, with maximum assessed value increasing, even with a constant property tax rate, the amount of tax deferred is going to go up each year by 3%. This is then the total amount that will have been deferred in any year. So if you're out here 5 years, the sum of these amounts is $1,113. Getting at the question I think that some of you were talking about, I did put a 6% rate in here to sort of get at present value. So if you ask what is the present value of this deferred property tax stream, it's this column over here. So while the total deferred is $1,000, you've got $1,250 in terms of its value as of 2004. And I don't really use that, but it's there for reference. The penalty then, this is the computation of the penalty, and it's essentially the same as the total down here to 2004, in which case you've been in the program 10 years. So it's the sum of the amount deferred for the first 10 years. As you move then to the next year, the penalty amount, essentially adds in the 282, but it subtracts out the 210. Okay? So that's the actual amount of penalties. So now if we begin to talk about the harvest, let's just get that over there. I look at three different ways in which this land might be managed. Four ways that might be managed in my full model. One is where it's sustained yield, and so actually they're cutting the same amount every year. And this is 60 acres, a rotation age of 60, and it's 100 acres. So if they cut 1 2/3 acre every year for 60 years, they will cut the full 100 acres. So this is the tax that they're paying in each year. And you can see how that compares. Essentially, it's actually higher than the property tax that they're paying in each year under the sustained yield, 234 versus 210. And with this rate increase, 3%, I've assumed 3% increase in the harvest tax rate. So it would increase just like maximum assessed value. What they're actually paying in harvest tax is higher each year. And if you were, in fact, to sum that up for the first 10 years here, you'd find that the amount... Can you see that? You can't see that.
Yeah.
Can you? The sum, anyway, is $2,683 compared with... should be the same.
2403 is the penalty.
Yeah. Right. 2403 would be the penalty. So there shouldn't be any penalty in the sense that they've been paying all along an amount equal to the amount deferred. But should they move out of this program, they would still be subject to a penalty. And if they're looking at this particular year and saying, do I want to move out of this program to save $305 in harvest tax? I think the answer is clearly no, because the penalty would be, get the year before there would be... cost you $2,130 to opt out of this program and then do a harvest of 1.6 acres in the following year and avoid paying $305 tax. You're not going to move out of the program. The other type of management process is still sort of even. You're cutting every year, but the stand is not even. You may have a concentration of young trees initially. In other words, it's going to be more than half of the rotation age before you get to harvesting those trees. So later in the rotation cycle, you're going to be harvesting more than 1/60th of your acreage. And the question again is there an incentive to opt out of this program? And you get the same answer essentially. Rather than $3 and $305, you in the year down here you would be talking about paying $455 in tax, and still comparing that with a penalty of over $2,000. So you're not going to leave the program. The answer gets less clear when you deal with a strategy where basically you don't cut for long periods of time, and then you cut a major portion of the acreage in your holding. And what I've done to ask this question, to answer this question, is not look at what you actually harvest in any year, but look at what would be the sort of threshold amount for your harvest so that the tax you pay is equal to the penalty in the prior year. So if we look at this example, if you were to harvest 8.1 acres, you would pay $1,356 in tax, and what you would have had to pay in penalty if you opted out of the program the year before is the same. So you're not going to do it. But if we move down here somewhere, again, you've got the same consideration, tax of 204, and that equals the penalty in the prior year. But if we, let's say we make this 25 acres, so you're going to, in this case, harvest a quarter of your crop. What happens then is you've got to, you're looking at, if you're in this year, which is what, say, the 12th year, the unlucky year. Say this is the 11th year, and you're looking at a major harvest of 25 acres in the next year, then you opt out of the program, pay your penalty over here, if I can get the right line, of $2,403, and the next year you harvest, but you don't pay $4,718 in harvest tax. And then what you do is come back into the program after that major harvest and, again, get the advantage of the 20%. You know, this is a problem, I guess, but I don't know how interesting or how serious a problem it is. Let's restore that. I don't know how much acreage would be managed in this way, and I'm not sure what you do about it either. How you might change the penalty to discourage this. One, you might increase it. You might make it related to the present value of the tax deferred so the state is always held harmless. But then you're getting back to, again, a property-by-property sort of association. Another suggestion was that you might prevent them from re-entering the program if they opt out. So they have to pay the 100% tax for the next 10 years or something like that. The other thing, I think, is maybe let's see how it works. The department has to come back in 2009 and report to us. That's how it's working.
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah, Representative Williams.
The one thing that I have learned from your homework assignment of having to read about most of the 50 states in this governing magazine is a lot about the way their various tax incentive and related programs work, and it leads me to believe that for the most part people will behave to their best economic benefit when analyzing this program. And so to the extent that it allows me, if it allowed me to harvest, and I had harvestable timber that included a quarter of my property, why wouldn't I do this, Dick? I mean, why wouldn't I opt out of the program, cut 25% of my stand, assuming that it was cuttable and the market price was right? And I acknowledge that some of that might be driven by market price, but at some point, why wouldn't I do that and then opt back in the program if we gave the opportunity for that to happen? I mean, the whole system is to avoid the tax if you can do it legally, and I don't know why I wouldn't do that. Is there another reason that would stop me from wanting to do that?
Let's ask Mr. Bentz. He's the small woodland owner.
Thank you, Chair Sherman.
Yeah.
And Representative Williams. The question is, why wouldn't you bail out? Another thing to remember, if you're looking down here, say you go to year 12 and now you harvest 25 acres. Well, again, we're assuming that today 100% of the tax has been paid. And if you had an even stand, as he was showing here in the first one, you've got 1.67 acres coming into maturity. So out of those 100 acres, you know, every year you've got 1 acre that comes to maturity.
Right.
And you're harvesting that acre and a half. Well, if you get to year 12 and you harvest 25 acres, that means you had 10 acres fully, you know, say you have 15 acres that's ready to harvest at year 11, but you harvest 25. Well, even if you did opt out of the system, that extra tax, in effect, is tax that's already been paid. How to get that? You only have 15 acres that's come to maturity during the time this program has been under this program of the deferral. That extra 10 acres that he harvested, if he's harvesting 25 acres, has already been taxed at 100% under the current program today. I could see this being a problem 30, 40 years from now if somebody's gone down and now has a harvest and we're rolling out. But, you know, we've got a lot of legislative sessions to deal with that, and I think the department is also going to be getting information. I mean, if people start gaming the system, you know, we shut it down. I think what we basically did was we put enough of a disincentive in there to make people think twice about it, to not do it on a willy-nilly type of basis, realizing that anybody who harvests probably in these first 10 years, unless they're just doing a small sustained yield basis, is in effect going to be overpaying their taxes. And there will be people that will do that simply for the benefit of being in this program. So I don't see that really as an issue of lost revenue to the department or to the counties. No.
I guess if I may, Mr. Chair, sort of I worked with the group essentially to come up with the rates for 389 and not so much the 303 but the 389. The model recognizes that there are going to be gainers and losers among the group who are in the program, and that's what's happening essentially, because I assume that that's how they're going to react. Basically, they're going to enter this program after they've made a major harvest, and they're not going to enter it if they're facing harvest in the near future. So the rate is higher because of that. And so the group is essentially paying at a rate which should be revenue neutral over an entire rotation cycle. And if people enter this program, I mean, right now even the sustained yield doesn't have an economic incentive to enter the program because they're paying more in harvest tax every year than they would be deferring in property tax. But they may choose very well, and that's how... people are arguing is that there are other reasons for entering this program other than economics. But if the entry is anything like I anticipated, or even if it's significantly larger as suggested, there are going to be losses in the first couple of bienniums, but over the rotation cycle, basically, this thing should be revenue neutral. Or even, it could even, in fact, raise more revenue.
Representative Bridger?
I have a question of Dick. If I opt out of the program, what system am I in?
You would move into the large owner program. You'd be at, assuming you still meet the requirements for that, through managing it as forest land, and you would be paid property tax at 100% and no harvest tax.
Right. And so... it would seem to me that the disincentive is if I opt out, then I don't get to opt back in. Because that would certainly not be an incentive for me to opt out and to fall into the large landowner basis. Otherwise, I would see people jumping in and out all the time. And I that to me is a loophole in this. I don't think that's a good idea.
Well, folks, we are out of time. I think what I'll do is ask Dick, Paul, do we have time for a work session on this on Wednesday? Let's schedule this for work session on Wednesday. We're out of time. I don't want to ram this thing through right now. I've got questions. Talk to Dick or talk to McNitt or Mr. Bentz or any of our witnesses today. We'll get this back up for work session on Wednesday. And with that, we're out of time, and I'm sorry, wait a second, we have three bills, sorry, we can do this very quickly. We have three bills before us for committee introduction,
LC 2337, transfers money from the state school fund to local option equalization grant. These are local option bills. 2339, again relating to local option distribution to the state school fund. And LC 2040 is a version of the hotel motel tax that's floating out. For the record, 2337 and 2339 are introduced as committee bills. 2040 is at the request of the League of Oregon Cities and Associated Oregon Industries. Again, as before, introduction of bills as committee bills is only for the purpose of getting them into the system, does not indicate any support by members of the committee or indicate that any particular action will be taken with regard to the bills. With that said, the chair would move introduction of House of LC 2337 and LC 2339 as committee bills. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Hearing none, those LCs are introduced as committee bills. Chair would move LC 2040 as introduction. At the request of League of Oregon Cities and Associated Oregon Industries, is there any discussion on that motion? Any objection? Hearing none, LC 2040 is introduced. Thank you very much. With that, then, we are adjourned until tomorrow.